I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story. The death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has led to an outpouring of grief across America. Ginsburg was a pioneering feminist and liberal icon on the Supreme Court.
Every issue that we here tonight care about hangs in the balance.
But it's not just sorrow being experienced by the political left, it's fear.
We won, and we have an obligation as the winners to pick who we want. That's not the next president. Hopefully I'll be the next president, but we're here
The
now.
Timing of Ginsburg's death just weeks before the November election has opened the door to a sharp political shift to the right inside America's highest court, an institution that protects some of the biggest gains in civil rights in recent decades.
Do you want to see the court overturn? You just said you want to see the court protect the Second Amendment. Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, that will happen. And that'll happen.
Today, how Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death could change America. It's Tuesday, the 29th of September.
It's pretty clear to me that people see this as a potential turning point for America's future. And to understand why that is, we obviously need to talk about what it means to lose a key liberal from the Supreme Court so close to an election.
Anushka Astana is editor-at-large for The Guardian and host of Today in Focus, where this episode first aired.
But we also need to understand Ginsburg herself and everything she did for women's rights. Take me back to the very start for her. What was it like becoming a young female lawyer in the 1960s?
You know, she encountered a lot of difficulty. She was a person from a working class background. She was a woman from Flatbush, Brooklyn. And when she made it to Harvard Law, she was one of only a few women in a class of almost entirely men.
Moira Donegan is a columnist for The Guardian US.
Nine women in a class of over 500.
At a school that had historically been exclusively male. So there was this infamous moment when she was in law school and the somewhat contemptuous dean of Harvard Law gathered his handful of women students together and asked them all how they justified taking a place that could have been filled by a man. And that sort of set the tone for her experiences as a young lawyer. She was denied a clerkship with the Supreme Court justice because he didn't want to hire a woman clerk.
These were pre-Title VII days, so employers were upfront about not wanting to hire women.
She was denied jobs at law firms from firms that didn't want to hire women or didn't want to hire mothers or didn't want to hire Jewish people.
Is that when she became politically driven, when her feminism grew?
Well, you know, she was not somebody who began as a great political ideologue, but when she was teaching law school, some of her female law students who were a little bit younger than her began pointing out the ways that state law enmeshed this assumption about what men's lives were like and what women's lives were like and codified those assumptions into law. So there were a lot of laws presuming that women would be dependent and presuming that men would be breadwinners.
I end up teaching. As I said before, that gave me time to devote to the movement for evening out the rights of women and men.
And these were sort of enforced in things like some laws didn't allow women to open bank accounts on their own or didn't allow women to get credit cards without approval of their husbands, all the way to things like codifying job discrimination. So, you know, it wasn't her own observation. It was something she was really pushed to by a younger generation. And her response to this was to create the first course, law school course, on women and the law in the United States. And eventually she became the founder of the American Civil Liberties Union's Women's Rights Project.
She clearly took that motivation to change things for women into her career as a lawyer. Tell me about the cases that she argued at the Supreme Court.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued six cases before the Supreme Court. She won five. Among the more significant ones were Reed versus Reed in 1971, Frontiero versus Richardson in 1973, Weinberger versus Weisenfeld in 1975. And, you know, she was a very strategic gender rights advocate. So what she did was she took cases to the Supreme Court that would be very amenable and reasonable to the then all-male body. And she often argued from a place not of extending women the same freedoms, but of extending them the same obligations. And she argued from a place of understanding how gender discrimination impacted men. And this was a argument for ending discrimination on the basis of sex under the law that was amenable to people who are not especially sympathetic.
I expect to see 3, 4, perhaps even more women on the high court bench, women not shaped from the same mold, but of different complexions. I surely would not be in this room today without the determined efforts of men and women who kept dreams of equal citizenship alive.
To the women's liberation cause, right? This is the 1970s, it's an all-male Supreme Court, and she won one case after another, sort of establishing precedents that made later victories easier.
So what you're saying is Ruth Bader Ginsburg used the Supreme Court to drive through rulings that genuinely changed the way women live their lives, and in doing so, arguably, began to shift that power balance that had long existed between the perceived roles in society of men and women. And what she did helps us to understand the significance of the Supreme Court more widely, with its 9 judges interpreting the freedoms set out in the US Constitution that apply across all states, whether it's ensuring African Americans can vote, or that LGBTQ people can marry the people they love, or most famously, whether women can access abortions. But on that, Ginsburg had some reservations about the Roe v. Wade ruling, didn't she? Can you explain why?
Yeah, this is interesting because later in life she became a feminist icon and sort of a beloved defender of women's rights. But at the time of her confirmation hearing in 1993, there was a great deal of feminist skepticism about Ruth Bader Ginsburg because of some comments she had made about Roe v. Wade.
Written a comment on Roe v. Wade. And it was not 100% applauding that decision.
Saying that the decision attempted to do too much too fast. You know, she emphasizes incremental change because she believes that incremental change is the easiest to defend. Her comments about Roe v. Wade saying that it did too much too fast is really not evidence of her opposition to abortion rights, but of her commitment to them. She believed that abortion rights should have been protected not under a supposed right to privacy, which is a much more constitutionally flimsy idea, as they were established in Roe v. Wade.
I thought Roe v. Wade was an easy case, and the Supreme Court could have held that most extreme law unconstitutional and put down its pen. Instead, the court wrote an opinion that made every abortion restriction in the country illegal in one fell swoop.
She wanted abortion rights protected under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, which would have been a much slower and more difficult precedent to establish, but it also would have been much, much harder for abortion rights opponents to take down. And what we see now is Roe v. Wade has been very much gutted. Now, with a conservative majority Supreme Court, Roe does not seem long for this world. And it is hard not to speculate that if it was the right to abortion was established on firmer legal ground, 14th Amendment grounds, then it would be much harder for conservatives to take it away.
Please be seated. Welcome to the White House. It is my distinct honor to introduce the Chief Justice.
In 1993, after a decade as a U.S. Court of Appeals judge for the District of Columbia, where Bader Ginsburg built up a reputation as a consensus-building pragmatist with fierce attention to detail, what did it mean for her to be President Bill Clinton's successful pick for the Supreme Court?
Justice Ginsburg, will you raise your right hand and repeat after me? I, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, do solemnly swear
I, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
You know, it was very significant to have more than one woman on the court. The first woman had been appointed to the Supreme Court under President Reagan. Her name was Sandra Day O'Connor. She and Ginsburg were the only two women on the court for quite some time.
Once said to me, she said, suppose we had come of age at a time when women lawyers were welcome at the bar. You know what? Today we would be retired partners from some large law firm.
And, you know, Ginsburg, as a feminist lawyer and feminist jurist, had a passion for women's rights that is very rarely admitted into the halls of power, right? This is something that made her very unique from Sandra Day O'Connor, who was not a passionate feminist the way that Ginsburg was, did not build her career on women's rights the way that Ginsburg did. Having Ginsburg on that court very much seemed like an assurance of the principle of women's rights under the law being recognized by the highest national legal body. There's a difference between having a woman on the court and having a feminist on the court. And, you know,
a big difference.
Yes. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was truly a feminist on the court.
Tell me how judges are picked.
They are selected by the president and then confirmed by the Senate. So they have to be voted out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and then confirmed with majority of senators. It used to be 60 senators. Now they only need 51. So nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate in what is typically a nasty media frenzy process.
But however nasty or frenzied it seems to have gotten now, that wasn't the case for her. She was voted in by 96 senators to 3 27 years ago.
Next tonight, day 2 of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg confirmation hearings.
Tell me what she's done during her tenure on the bench.
You know, she was present particularly for the very rapid expansion over the past 10 or 15 years of rights to LGBT people. So she was a crucial vote in Windsor versus United States, which won federal recognition of same-sex marriages, and then a case called Obergefell, which nationalized the right to same-sex marriage. She was the first Supreme Court justice to officiate a same-sex marriage. I believe she did that in her chambers.
Justice Bader Ginsburg officiated the wedding of Daryl and Jackie Friedman in 2017. Daryl is a professional opera singer and performed at the Washington...
She was a crucial vote to defend abortion rights, which are sort of perennially imperiled at the court. And she was really famous for this 2013 dissent in a case called Shelby County versus Holder.
The worst case, I think, was the Voting Rights Act case.
I mean, which was a case about the 1965 Voting Rights Act and voting rights for primarily African Americans in the South. You know, during her career, the court shifted pretty substantially to the right, and her own politics moved quite a bit to the left. She issued a lot of dissents. She was usually not in the majority. She was usually upholding principles of equality and justice under the law that were not being supported by her colleagues on the court.
The genius of the United States is that over now the course of more than two centuries, the notion of we the people has become ever larger. So the people who were once left out, like women, like African Americans, like Native Americans, are now part of that we the people. So I see the Constitution as striving for a more perfect union.
One of those dissents from the majority view of the other Supreme Court justices was over the election result in 2000. Tell me what happened.
In the year 2000, there was a contested election. The winner of the popular vote did not win the election because he did not win the Electoral College. There was a recount of the votes in Florida, which attempted to discover which candidate the Florida's electoral votes would be awarded to. And there was a large Republican effort to stop the recount and award the electoral votes to George W. Bush. And eventually this conflict went to the Supreme Court, which was tasked with awarding the election.
Good evening, everybody. I'll make it quick and simple to beginning. The Supreme Court of the United States has reversed the decision of the Florida Supreme Court, on three separate issues that were before that court. But get it in your mind, first of all, the Supreme Court of the United States has reversed the orders of the Florida Supreme Court on a very narrow majority. 5 justices to 4. 5 voted to reverse. And 4 voted not to.
And it ruled in favor of George Bush. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, she is a stickler for procedure. And she issued a uncommonly frank dissent, really kind of shaming her colleagues for allowing votes to not be counted, to allow those voices to not be heard.
I will announce a dissent from the bench if I think that the court not only got it wrong, but egregiously wrong.
She thought it was an undemocratic decision.
She almost became a celebrity figure. What drove that? Did she embrace it?
You know, towards the end of her life, particularly after that Shelby County versus Holder dissent, she attained this pop culture status. You know, people called her Notorious RBG, which is sort of a nod to the rapper Notorious B.I.G., who was also from Brooklyn.
Yo, this country man
or woman,
it's crazy.
Crazy.
You know there's only like one lady holding the whole damn thing together, right? This is you, RBG.
You know, there's a playful conflation, you know, because she is this Jewish grandmother and she was being compared to a rapper. But, you know, there was a sense, I think, people made her into a symbol of that dream of women's equality. That was being sort of perennially attacked and imperiled and eroded at the national level. In the last years of her life, she really became a meme.
Yo, tell him your favorite RBG decision, dog. I don't know. Come on.
You know, there were tote bags, there were bobbleheads of her. You could get a little enamel pin of her face. And, you know, in all this pop culture kitsch around Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her life and her longevity and her image, I see a lot of anxiety about what happens to the Republic and to women's rights in a world without her.
That anxiety is being driven by the fact that this isn't just about the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this amazing feminist who became so important to liberals from the Supreme Court. It's the prospect of who takes her place, a new appointment who is likely to have completely different values. And that fear was already being felt at the end of the Obama presidency. There was deadlocking Congress, the Supreme Court makeup was coming under increased scrutiny. And so the suggestion was actually made at the time that despite the Supreme Court role being one for life, Ginsburg could retire while a Democratic president still had time to choose a replacement. Why didn't she step down?
There's a few reasons for this. One is that, according to her, she quite liked the job and wanted to stay in it.
It's not clear who's going to be elected in the next election, unless you, of course, think it will be Hillary Clinton or some other Democrat.
I think I should do this job as long as I can do it full steam. And when I begin to slow down, I think I will know. It hasn't happened yet.
There's another that's sort of a little more speculative, because this is not the kind of thing that a Supreme Court justice would comment on in public. But there is a lot of speculation that she thought that Hillary Clinton would win the 2016 presidential election and that Hillary Clinton would appoint a more pugnacious and ideologically committed liberal to the Supreme Court than President Obama would. President Obama faced a Senate opposition and really Senate obstructionism to his judicial appointments, not only to the Supreme Court, but really up and down the federal bench. And Ginsburg thought that if she was able to hold on and retire under a President Hillary Clinton, then she would be able to ensure a more liberal replacement. That, of course, turned out to be a tremendous miscalculation. You know, it was a bet that she lost.
Do you know whether she regretted it?
I think that's the kind of thing she would never have said. Like virtually all American politicians who ascend to a national level, she had a tremendous faith in her own abilities. And, you know, I don't think she wanted to retire simply because other people said that it was the right thing to do. I think she wanted to go on her own time. Whether she regretted that decision in the end is, you know, not something I think we'll ever know. We do know that one of her dying wishes, as dictated to her granddaughter in the last days of her life, was that she did not want to be replaced by President Trump. She wanted to be replaced by his successor.
Is to honor her last words that she not be replaced until a new president is installed.
And of course, her unexpected death so close to the election might now mean that's impossible. But if we rewind 4 years, this exact thing happened. A Supreme Court justice died in an election year. What happened then?
Yeah, so Justice Antonin Scalia, who is a arch conservative on the court, died in March of 2016. He and Justice Ginsburg were actually very close friends. They went to the opera together, and he died in March. He had, I believe, a heart attack in his sleep. And the Republican-controlled Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, said that March 2016 was too close to the election.
Will we allow the people to continue deciding who will nominate the next justice? Or will we empower a lame duck president to make that decision on his way out the door instead?
And that they would wait until the new president was sworn in. The Democrats and President Obama, of course, said this was ridiculous. They nominated a federal circuit judge named Merrick Garland, but the Republicans refused to give him a hearing. And they held that seat open for most of that year and swore in Justice Neil Gorsuch to fill the seat after Trump took office. So now we have a significantly closer to an election death of Justice Ginsburg. And the Republicans have miraculously had a change of heart about the proximity of filling judicial vacancies in an election year.
More than sufficient time to process a nomination. History and precedent make that perfectly clear. Others want to claim this situation is exactly analogous to Justice Scalia's passing in 2016, and so we should not proceed until January. This is also completely false.
And they are now going to proceed to attempt to fill that seat either before November 3rd or during the lame duck period.
Of course, the thing that 2016 had in common with now is that Republican majority in the Senate that is so key to this appointment. Back then, Trump was able to make sure his first appointment was a conservative, and then came a choice that caused massive controversy.
Regarding one of the most profound responsibility of the President of the United States, and that is the selection of a Supreme Court justice. I've often heard that other than matters of war and peace, this is the most important decision a president will make. It is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
Brett Kavanaugh, despite lurid allegations about his treatment of women, was ultimately confirmed by that Republican-controlled Senate, meaning that conservatives went from being in the minority in the Supreme Court to a notional 5-4 majority. Did that change how Ginsburg behaved in her role?
Yeah, the Trump appointees really shifted the court significantly to the right. The appointment of Neil Gorsuch maintained the 5-4 liberal balance of the court. Then Justice Anthony Kennedy retired. Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to replace him, thereby establishing a 5-4 conservative majority. Now with Ginsburg gone and likely to be replaced by a conservative, you know, Ginsburg was quite frank in her disdain for President Trump. She assessed his character in public, which she got quite a bit of criticism for.
Called Donald Trump a faker and questioned the fact that he had not turned over his tax returns.
But that was quite controversial. It's seen as something that should be beneath the dignity of a Supreme Court judge. But, you know, the stakes for ordinary Americans of a conservative court and of Trump nominees to the court are quite high. So there was a very recent abortion rights case, which was very narrowly decided in a way that upheld a recent precedent. It's unlikely, I think, that the court will be that cautious in the future.
Next, how will Donald Trump's appointee to the court change it and its likely decisions?
Given all of that, everything you've told me, how did the country respond when we got the news on Friday that sadly Ginsburg had died due to complications from cancer at the age of 87?
There's a sense among American liberals, it's Murphy's Law, right? Everything bad that can happen will happen. And so her passing so close to an election year forebodes a very dark future. And I think a lot of Americans on the left and women in particular are, you know, quite afraid. They're afraid about the future of their own civil liberties. They're afraid about the aftermath of this fall's presidential election and how that will be managed if and when the election is contested. I think people are quite scared on the left, you know, and on the right, they're quite giddy. There is a sense that the long-awaited rollback of abortion rights in particular and of, you know, gay rights will finally be delivered for the conservative movement. This is what they put up with Donald Trump for.
And you can really see that emotion. You can see the fear of liberal America in the response. You can see how worried people are about what might happen as the Supreme Court shifts further to the right. But as you mentioned too, you can also see the giddiness on the right. Just on Friday morning, I was listening to my colleague Jonathan Friedland present US Politics Weekly, another podcast here, and say that at Trump rallies, they were still chanting, lock her up, lock her up. They were still chanting about Hillary Clinton. But since Friday, they've been chanting, fill her seat.
Well, I hope they hear. So the chant, this is a new one. Fill that seat. This is the chant. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to fill the seat.
This is a big deal for them.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to understate the asymmetry of enthusiasm about the court in the U.S. It is very much a animating force for the right wing in a way that it is not for the left wing. And that really wasn't true until about a decade following Roe v. Wade. It is a like sort of singularly passionate issue in the conservative mind.
But they're interested right now because they're very worried about what might happen. And in many ways, it feels like there is a huge, huge time constraint. This is a period in which an election is just weeks away. As you've already said, Mitch McConnell argued 4 years ago that it wouldn't be right to replace someone at a time like this. That attitude has changed, hasn't it? Conversations are already underway. Tell me what those conversations are.
Well, you know, there's a perennial sort of surprise on the American left at the capacity for like mendacity and hypocrisy of the conservative movement, right? You know, McConnell can't get away with being this hypocritical. This is somebody who cares about power. So the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, a senator from New York, he issued word for word the same statement that Mitch McConnell issued for the death of Antonin Scalia. You know, the American people deserve a say in who this next justice is, so we should hold the seat open until after the election.
If that was how Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans justified their mindless obstruction of President Obama's nominee, surely they must abide by their own standard.
There's a sense of despair, I think, among American liberals and people on the left who care about the court, because there is really very little procedural leverage available to stop the Senate Republicans from ramming through a arch-conservative judge to the highest court.
One thing that is the same in 2016 now is that the Republicans have a majority in the Senate.
Yeah. Before the Trump administration, appointments to the Supreme Court required a 60-vote majority to be appointed in the Senate, and now they require only 51 votes. Republicans have 51 votes. They also have the vote of the vice president, who can vote in the Senate to break a tie. They're saying there are three or four Republicans who would need to be peeled off. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, a Republican senator, has pledged not to vote for a Supreme Court nominee before the election. The moral good sense of these moderate or so-called moderate Republican senators is something that comes up every time there is a new Supreme Court vacancy. It was a big deal in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, when a man who was sort of credibly accused of sexual assault was put before the Senate for confirmation to the Supreme Court right in the height of the Me Too movement. Hope that these people can be persuaded to do the right thing. I think that hope might be a little bit misguided.
Right, because of the four Republicans who had been floated as possibly blocking this, at least two seem very likely to support the president, including Lindsey Graham, who could not have been stronger in 2016 about his view that a justice should not be replaced in an election year.
This is the last year of a lame duck president. And if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump get to be president, they've all asked us not to confirm or take up a selection by President Obama. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
If this is being rushed through before the election and then Joe Biden wins, is there anything he can do?
Yeah. So an idea that has gathered a degree of steam on the American left is the idea of court packing. So there are traditionally nine judges, justices on the Supreme Court, but that's actually not written anywhere. It is a tradition without the force of law. And it is entirely theoretically legal for a Democratic president, if he also has the Senate, to add seats to the Supreme Court and thereby expand the balance. It would be tremendously politically difficult. It would be tremendously controversial. The only other president who has attempted this in the past was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who faced a tremendous amount of pushback and eventually backed off on his plan.
A hypothetical question. If he's elected president and Democrats gain control of the Senate, would he consider adding more seats to the Supreme Court?
It's a legitimate question, but let me tell you why I'm not going to answer that question.
But, you know, it is an idea that has gained a lot of traction because of the sort of undemocratic way in which judges are appointed in the first place.
Already we know that there are terrible things happening in states across the US where it is becoming incredibly hard to access abortions. But if the Supreme Court were to actually overturn Roe v. Wade, what would it mean?
The overturning of Roe v. Wade would affirm the status quo, because even though abortion is technically legal nationwide, it is practically accessible really only in blue states. So there are places in the U.S. where there are myriad restrictions on who can get an abortion, when and how. They are very expensive. They tend not to be, you know, in red states, they tend not to be covered by health insurance for people who have them. They are not covered by state insurance for the poor. You have these tremendous obstacles in terms of what sort of procedures are allowed, in terms of how many visits you have to make. Effectively, abortion is already de facto illegal in many states, and Roe v. Wade would sort of formalize that and make it a legal fact on the ground, as well as simply just a lived reality on the ground the way it is now.
What other landmark decisions could be under threat?
Something that people really worry about is Griswold versus Connecticut, which is a case from the 1960s, which establishes the right of married couples to access birth control. I think we're going to see an even further erosion of voting rights. The 2013 decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act has led to quite a bit of voter suppression efforts, particularly in red states, particularly targeting Black voters. You know, nationwide legality of gay marriage is only 5 years old, and it is likely to be rolled back and sent back to the states.
And you mentioned the election, which Donald Trump has already said that he would contest. If the Supreme Court has a 6-3 slant towards the conservative side, would that make it much more likely that contesting any election might be successful?
Yeah, so the new composition of the Supreme Court means that Donald Trump is much more likely to be sort of installed as president for another term if he is able to contest the presidential election in the fall. You know, we already saw this in Bush v. Gore in 2000. This is going to be an even more logistically complicated election because of the pandemic. So we're going to have large numbers of vulnerable people, many of them Democrats, trying to vote by mail so as to avoid the viral risk of voting in person.
Moira, from everything you've told me, it's clear why the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has shaken liberal America to its core. Not only has the country lost one of its most committed and arguably effective feminists, but her death at this moment opens up the possibility of a sharp swing to the right in an institution that has so much say over how Americans can live their lives. Her own words from her deathbed tell you the significance, the possibility of a new Supreme Court that could unwind all those rights that she fought for. But is there a slightly positive note for those on the left or centre of politics in America to end on? Is there any chance that these justices could be more independent and nuanced than we think? You know, I recently read about Brett Kavanaugh, arguably the most conservative figure on there, quashing the conviction of a black man on death row, Curtis Flowers, because of clear evidence of racial discrimination by the prosecutor in jury selection. If Trump gets his appointment in time, could we still see unexpected behaviour from these justices?
Yeah, you know, there is a silver lining to the sort of constitutional quirks of the Supreme Court, which means that, you know, these people, these justices who have lifetime appointments, a tremendous amount of independence once they're on there, right? So you have issues where sort of the personal soft spots or hobby horses of these individual justices lead to unexpected legal outcomes. For instance, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was a Republican appointee and was sort of, you know, expected to be this pretty reliable conservative vote on the court, turned out to have a great personal belief in gay rights and was a very reliable pro-gay vote on the court up until his retirement. So, you know, there are opportunities for independence and for these people with, you know, a tremendous amount of job security to surprise you.
Moira Donegan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today. This episode first aired on the Today in Focus podcast, made by The Guardian in London. If you liked it, you can get more by searching for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was presented by Anushka Astana and produced by Serena Barker Singh. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier and additional production by Miles Martignoni. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Okay. I'll see you back here tomorrow.